This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell with you here on this Thursday morning. Hey, coming up on the show, there's lots of health concerns in Papua New Guinea at the moment as COVID cases rise. But some doctors are particularly concerned about pregnant women and deaths on maternity wards. In about 5 minutes, Dr. Mary Bagida, who's the coordinator for obstetrics and gynaecology at the Port Moresby General Hospital, is going to join me to give us an update on all that's happening there. And also, have you heard the term climate finance floating around? You might have, because COP26 global climate talks are fast approaching and Pacific countries want to see serious discussions about funds to help them on the front line of climate change.
The Pacific Islands that are bearing the brunt of climate crisis must be compensated for the damage that they have already experienced and support to protect the people, the land and their culture from climate destruction.
I'll have an explainer for you on all things Pacific, climate and money coming up in about 30 minutes' time. And talking of climate change, we've also got a story for you about researchers who are looking for taro in Australian rivers because rising sea levels is making it harder to grow in the Pacific. That's coming up in about 40 minutes.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
First, though, the Minister for Health in Papua New Guinea, Jelta Wong, says that work has started on a 500-bed field hospital in Port Moresby as the country's COVID-19 outbreak continues to escalate. The latest status report says another 288 cases have been recorded, taking the total to almost 25,400, with more than 300 deaths. Less than 2% of the population has had at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, and doctors in the capital have been prescribing a worm treatment that the World Health Organization says is dangerous. Administrators at Port Moresby General Hospital say that it is over capacity and in crisis, with 68 people having died there in the past month. Now, Mackenzie Smith has been speaking to Minister Wong to find out more about how the government plans to respond.
We've already started working on creating more bed space. We're fortunate enough to have people that are building some extra space in some areas. If worst comes to worst, we will, with the help of Australia, we will build a basic hospital camp within another stadium in the city.
Is there a timeline for that?
We've already started the work on it, so it should become operational in the next 2 to 3 weeks. That'll be another 500-person hospital base.
There have been several pregnant women who have died in hospital in Port Moresby over the past week from COVID-19. Can you be doing more to protect pregnant women?
At this point of time, Pom Jen is looking after the maternal mothers and that. But, you know, mothers that have just got pregnant and that urge to get the vaccine to give them the extra immunity boost when they're going through their pregnancy, because in the last months of the pregnancy, the system allows different, it's not as, the immunity is not as strong. And Professor Glenn Muller, who's head of the gynecology here in Port Moresby, stresses to people that they should hold off on any pregnancy if they can. But if they're already pregnant, then they are looking at ways to ensure that they look after the mothers. So far, we've lost, I think, 8 to 10 mothers already through the COVID Delta variant.
Doctors in Port Moresby have been prescribing ivermectin to patients to treat COVID-19. And that's despite the WHO warning against this treatment. What are your thoughts on that?
The ivermectin is given to COVID-19 patients and the side effects of it causes problems. Then they will have to face the medical board and be responsible for their actions.
So there might be consequences for these doctors?
I was on talkback with Professor Muller the other day, and ivermectin, there's no science behind the ivermectin being a cure for COVID. It's used for a different purpose, which is for worms and different types of diseases that have have nothing to do with COVID, but some doctors may have prescribed it to people and they've got results. So we've asked WHO to give us a proper analysis on the ivermectin and how it works.
Will you look at banning the prescription of ivermectin for COVID-19?
It is something we're looking at. It's before the medical board at this point of time. As soon as they give me back an answer, then I will put the message out.
There's also reports of oxygen shortages for treating patients. How desperate of a need is there and how are you looking at managing supplies?
We have the supply in country. It's just the prescribing and the ensuring that the oxygen is available because of the numbers that are coming in way above what they forecasted. So we are doing what we can to get extra oxygen into the country, and that's thanks to the Indonesian government who have come on board and decided to send us a couple of containers of oxygen tanks to help us fight the Delta variant.
When is that happening?
We've written to the Indonesian embassy, and they have, at this point in time, they have putting the oxygen together, ready to send across to Papua New Guinea.
That's Papua New Guinea's Health Minister, Jelta Wong, and he was speaking there to reporter Mackenzie Smith. And the head of obstetrics and gynaecology at the Port Moresby General Hospital, Dr. Glenn Moeller, says they're dealing with 1 to 2 deaths a day on the maternity wing there. It's a situation that's only adding to the alarm of health officials as the number of COVID-19 cases continues to climb and hospitals are collapsing under the burden. Now, Dr. Mary Bagita is the coordinator for obstetrics and gynaecology at Port Moresby General and joins me on the line this morning. Good morning, Dr. Bagita.
Good morning.
Dr. Bagita, how are you and your team feeling at the moment as you're facing these rising COVID-19 cases?
Well, nervous. We were expecting this surge around this time. So although many of us were mentally and physically prepared, it's been quite overwhelming. So, yeah, quite distressing also.
And in terms of it being distressing, what are you seeing happen in the maternity wards right now in relation to women and COVID-19?
Okay, so we've really had a large, much higher number of women testing positive this time around, and women who've come with more severe symptoms. So since we started seeing a rise in the beginning of September, we've tested more than 100 pregnant women positive. And so we've tested, I can't give you the exact numbers, but probably around 200 to 300 women. And out of that, 120 or so have returned positive.
And have you seen any deaths of pregnant women who have tested positive to COVID-19?
Yeah, so in the last 5 weeks or so since this surge began, we've lost 3 mothers to COVID. The last one was only last week. So, yeah.
And what about their newborn children, their infants? Are they being impacted as well by the mothers testing positive to COVID-19?
Well, definitely. These 3 maternal deaths we've had in the last 2 weeks, they were still pregnant when they died. So they died with their babies in them. So, yeah, it's quite distressing because they also came with severe symptoms. So they presented not because of the pregnancy, but because of their COVID symptoms.
And could you talk me through perhaps what experience these women are going through when they do turn up to the maternity ward with COVID-19? There might be pregnant women who don't potentially realise the risk that they're putting themselves and their children in by perhaps not getting vaccinated. What exactly are these women who do turn up and testing positive? What kind of process and experience do they go through when they're with you?
Yes, so we have We have our midwives in the clinic who do an awareness session every morning, especially with the new moms who are presenting to start their antenatal care. We also have awareness messages and talks by the midwives in the clinic for those who have already booked and are continuing their care in the clinic. So basically, it's about taking them through what COVID is and the risks to pregnant women. Pregnant women are at much higher risk of developing severe disease and dying, especially in the last trimester. So those are the kind of messages that are given. And we try to reassure the pregnant women as much as possible that the vaccine is quite safe to take, very safe to take. It's safer to take and prevent disease than to just sit it out and see if whether you get COVID or not. And also that it's protective to the unborn baby.
And right now, what vaccines are available for pregnant women in Papua New Guinea?
We have AstraZeneca at the moment and J&J coming soon.
Are you seeing hesitancy from pregnant women or when they do present with COVID-19, are they asking to be vaccinated?
Good question. There's a lot of vaccine hesitancy here in the country. Like, it's just widespread, quite unbelievable, even after, we counsel and talk and give messages. It's just overwhelming. So we've got some uptake of pregnant women getting vaccinated, but not enough.
My guest this morning is Dr. Mary Begida from PomGen's coordinator for obstetrics and gynecology, talking to me at the moment about how pregnant women in Papua New Guinea are being affected by COVID-19 as the cases rise in the country there. Dr. Begida, how many of your colleagues have been infected with COVID-19?
This time around, we've had three doctors out of almost 30 of us in the ONG division. So three so far have been infected. Two of them quite mild symptoms, but one a bit more serious, but she's recovering well. And I guess the benefit is we've all been vaccinated. So our team is 100% vaccinated.
That's excellent to hear that you've got that vaccination and that protection there, and that the cases have been relatively okay, people recovering as well. Are you concerned at all that your team might have to be moved towards COVID-19 care and that women might be left behind because of it?
Yeah, exactly. This time around, we've been really overwhelmed. As a hospital, the whole hospital has been quite overwhelmed. So initially we had an 18-bed COVID unit in the general area. But in the last month, that has really had to be increased. So at the moment, we've had to open up two other wards to cater for COVID-positive patients and 3 tents outside. The emergency department is full, mostly COVID patients. And so at the moment, there's probably around 160 to 170 inpatients total throughout the hospital. Most of them are moderate to severe cases. And it's just been so overwhelming. In the last surge, we were informed that we had a total in the 3 months of 81 admissions. Now we have much, much more than that. It's like 140, 50, 160 inpatients at any one time.
And how long do you think the hospital and the staff at the hospital can sustain these many cases coming in?
Not sure. This surge has just started. So we're looking at, probably another month or more, trying to look after COVID patients. and really not sure how long we're going to be able to cope with the situation here. We have our other colleagues in other provinces, you know, been affected by COVID as well. So they're needing help. They're calling us for help. We also need to help ourselves. So we're really stretched to the limit. For ONG, we have a 12-bed unit for COVID. And the last surge, we had about, you know, maximum 3 to 4 patients at any one time. Now our 12-ward bed is almost fully occupied every day.
Mm. What support do you need right now to ensure that your team and those at the hospital are going to be able to continue providing maternal services to pregnant women?
I think the main thing is trying to drive vaccinations so that we get as many people vaccinated as possible. And our major, major issue is human resource. For doctors, in ONG, all of us have been vaccinated. For the midwives, the vaccine hesitancy has been quite high, so quite low vaccination rates amongst midwives. So this time around, a lot of them have fallen ill. It's affecting our care in the labor ward, in the wards. So, yeah. Quite situation where we're having to, you know, stretch our manpower once again, and this time with a more serious variant.
Yeah, definitely really concerning. What sort of message would you have for women in particular who are pregnant and, you know, would be thinking about coming to use your services at PomGen in the lead up while they are pregnant? What's your message to them at this time?
Yeah, firstly, vaccination. That's the number one message. Get vaccinated, protect yourself, protect your unborn child, and protect everyone around you. Pass the message to get vaccinated. Don't listen and watch too many social media, you know, fake news and all that stuff. And the second message is if you're not pregnant, don't get pregnant.
Dr. Mary Begita, hope you're able to stay as safe as possible and that, yeah, help can come to you guys in the maternal wards there at PomGen. An important message there for all pregnant women, you know, across PNG to get vaccinated if possible. Dr. Mary Begita, thank you so much for joining me here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Mary Begita, PomGen's coordinator for obstetrics and gynecology, speaking to me there.
This is a public health message about the COVID-19 situation in the Pacific region.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mengu Kendino, an emergency physician in Port Moresby. In times of health emergencies, it's important to have accurate information. Doctors, nurses, and health workers have the most accurate information about COVID-19. Health workers can advise you on how to keep yourself and your community safe and what to do if you feel unwell. Always check the source of information you read or watch on COVID-19. Don't share information on social media or WhatsApp unless you are sure that it's from a trusted source. Being well informed will help protect our community from coronavirus.
This is a public health message about the COVID-19 situation in the Pacific region.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Thursday morning. Coming up still on the show in about 10 minutes' time, I've got an explainer for you about climate finance. I'm not sure if you've heard that term floating around. You're probably going to hear it a little bit more in the lead up to the huge global climate talks that are going to be happening in November, COP26. Unfortunately, not all Pacific countries are going to be able to attend, but they do have a list of demands for bigger economies to help them out because, of course, Pacific Islands are on the front line of climate change. One of those things is wanting a fair amount of money to help people build bridges, build drains, build ways to, you know, fortify themselves against rising sea levels. So climate finance, an explainer for you coming up very soon.
Hold the front page!
Time now to find out about all the headlines making news around the region. I'm joined by Richard Hewitt this morning. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Jordan.
Richard, let's head first over to Papua New Guinea. Nervous times for people of Manamotu, where the island's volcano has sprung to life again.
It has. MTV posting pictures of a dense ash cloud hanging over the island this after an eruption that's estimated to have lasted for around an hour. The ash and steam is said to have covered the whole island, and the pictures would certainly support that. Thick smoke apparently drifting as far as Bogia Station on the mainland. Now, as you can imagine, the relevant authorities are keeping a very close watch on the situation. Up in Darwin, here in northern Australia, the Volcanic Ash Advisory Centre, they've issued a warning about an ash plume rising above 15,000 metres and moving northwest at around 10 knots, but the plume is expected to dissipate around now, so that's encouraging. The Manam volcano, which is in Madang province and some 13 kilometres off PNG's northern coast, is one of the most active in the country. When it last erupted some 3 years ago now, large numbers of islanders were forced to evacuate their homes, and it was a pretty terrible time for all concerned. So hopefully the volcano calms down ASAP.
Yes, fingers crossed. Now let's head over to Solomon Islands. Some news on the COVID-19 front and a border warning from the Prime Minister, Manese Sogavare.
Yeah, I mean, and this is particularly interesting for a country which has next to no COVID-19 cases at all, and certainly none in the community. Now, the Solomon's government has set a vaccination target figure of 90%, but right now, Mr. Sogavare has told his people that figure stands at just 12%, or around 45,000 people. He's now urging those who have had their first dose of vaccine, that's some 108,000 people, to get their second dose, as that would put the total percentage of fully protected people clearly up significantly. The Prime Minister is actually warning that if vaccination rates don't rise from the current average of 7,000 doses per week, it could be March 2023 before the country's borders are reopened. Mr. Sogavare wants to see the numbers rise to 20,000 doses per week, at which rate the borders could be open in June next year, which is still some way away. So, yeah, it's interesting what's going on in Solomon Islands. You would think people want to get the country back to normal, but clearly we're seeing similar problems to those occurring in other Pacific Island countries, the whole question of hesitancy.
Yeah, definitely. It's a shame. Would have loved to fly over to Solomon Islands, see our colleague Evan Wasuka, who's based in Honiara. But could be a little while potentially.
Well, also bear in mind they've got the Pacific Games in 2023. Now they're going to be at the back end of the year. They've been put back already because of fairly obviously pandemic fallout concerns. But borders don't open until March. There's always the possibility that it could be even later.
Yeah.
So yeah, they do need to get a move on. So yeah, hopefully people will rally to the cause.
Definitely. Okay, let's turn over to some sports news. The Fiji Rugby Union have put out a clarification on the status of national men's coach Vern Cotter ahead of the Flying Fijians' upcoming tour of Europe.
Yeah, I think this is a case of a lot of people rushing to conclusions. After we told you the other day, the FIU announced that outgoing Sevens coach Gareth Baber, who's now back home in his native Wales, will take on the role of 15s coach for Fiji's tour because of the complications involved in getting Vern Cotter and his staff over to Europe from New Zealand, where they're currently based, and more significantly, back again. But regardless of the arrangement, the FIU's chief executive, John O'Connor, says Cotter is still very much the head coach, and he and his assistants will be closely involved throughout the tour, albeit from a distance. Cotter himself says all the coaches are meeting frequently via Zoom, the entire world's meeting via Zoom, and exchanging information, and they will be involved in strategy and team selection as the matches against Spain, Wales and Georgia approach. The head coach adding, "We don't want to get in the way, but we will certainly have our views before preparing for each match." But as I suggested yesterday, if Gareth Baber were to win all three games, particularly the one against Wales, it might just throw the cat amongst the coaching pigeons, mightn't it?
Yeah, very interesting. And saying still in the sports world, since Moana, Pacifica was confirmed as a starter in the new look Super Rugby Pacific competition next year. The debate has continued over just how representative of Samoa and Tonga the team is actually going to be. But it seems that Samoa tourism are not in any doubt, really.
No doubt whatsoever, it would appear. It's throwing its weight behind Moana as the team's official tourism partner, with both sides hopeful of matches being played in Samoa once COVID-19 restrictions ease up enough to allow that to happen, basically. Moana trustee Debbie Sorensen says they are humbled by Samoa tourism's support when the industry has been hit so hard over the last couple of years. She goes on to say that the team's goal has always been to play some of their games in the Pacific because it will be great for our people, great for the game, and great to bolster tourism. tourism. As a result of the partnership, the beautiful Samoa logo will be displayed prominently on the back of the players' match day jerseys. And Debbie Sorensen concludes by saying, Samoa is a rugby-loving nation and an enchanting holiday destination that needs support as international borders open up. So, yeah, it could be mutually beneficial. Yeah. Having said that, the lady signing for Moana is the first player who's not connected to Tonga or Samoa, but a bit of a rising star anyway. So, I mean, I think we always knew this was likely to happen. But every other player so far has either Samoan or Tongan connections.
And I think when we were talking about this a bit earlier in the week, have there been seven people listed in the team? Is that what's, and there's still a couple more to come?
I'm trying to think. There was one announcement yesterday. I think that takes the number up to, it's either seven or nine. Yeah. I mean, they're eventually, I mean, they say they've signed 30 players, so they're just going to drip feed us. Just as the Andrew and the Fijian Andrew have
potentially
done as well.
Heaps more representation. Yeah. Though.
Although interesting, I saw a picture the other day of the Fijian Andrew squad because they presented their credentials to the president in Fiji.
Oh.
So I'm assuming that there are players in that picture whose names have not yet been announced as being part of the team.
And yet, so, there's photo evidence.
There's photo evidence that they have clearly signed a contract. Yes.
Very interesting. Well, Richard Hewitt, thank you so much for bringing us those updates.
No problem, Jordan.
Let's take a look at weather around the region now, starting off with a sunny day in PNG's capital, Port Moresby. It is going to be fine all day and looking to a top of 32 degrees. Bit different over in Suva, however, it's going to be cloudy this morning and then showers throughout the day, reaching a top of 29 degrees. It's also going to be raining all day in Port Vila in Vanuatu. They're reaching a top of 27 degrees. Over in Honiara, it's going to be fine this morning, but a chance of showers and possibly thunderstorms developing in the afternoon. A high of 30 degrees is what they'll be looking at. 29 degrees in Apia in Samoa, and cloudy today with brief showers expected in the afternoon. And a beautiful day over in Nuku'alofa in Tonga. It's going to be sunny, mainly fine weather, and a top of 27 degrees.
They were trying to make it for the hills up there, but they didn't make it.
A lot of people lost their homes.
Know what to do.
Know what to do.
Know what to do.
Know what to do.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
8:30 a.m. Fridays and 10:30 a.m. Saturdays, PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat. And I don't need to tell you that Pacific Island countries are the most exposed and vulnerable to climate change and natural disasters. Efforts to adapt to climate change are critical, but they're also really costly. Some countries already have high and rising debt levels, which have been further exacerbated by the pandemic. And since climate change is primarily caused by emissions from larger, more developed countries, Pacific Islands are calling on those bigger countries to take financial responsibility. This is the sound of a canary. Coal miners used to use them as an early warning system for dangers in the mines.
We refuse to be the proverbial canaries in the world's coal mine. We want more for ourselves than to be helpless songbirds whose demise serves as a warning to others.
Pacific leaders like Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama have had enough.
Fiji and the Pacific's demands are clear. The developed world must deliver on the $100 billion promised in climate finance.
While Pacific leaders are negotiating for climate action at Glasgow, back home in the South Pacific, they know they can't negotiate with the beginning of the cyclone season.
We're suffering.
That's Garth Henderson, Cook Islands Secretary of Finance.
We are the canaries in the coal mine. Help us adapt to the consequences of emissions that we didn't create.
In order to survive, Pacific countries need money.
Climate finance is the flow of finance to support developing countries in the Pacific to mitigate the impacts of climate change or to adapt to the impacts of climate change.
That's Tangaloa Cooper-Halo, Director of Climate Change Resilience at SPREP.
These are costs that have been imposed on Pacific countries through no action of their own, through no fault of their own. And therefore, it is important for the developed world who are responsible for increased emissions, that there is this responsibility to small developing countries to provide funding support for them.
Pacific countries see climate finance as a form of climate justice. Many people are afraid of what's going to happen to their land. Like Maina Talia, the secretary of the Tuvalu Climate Action Network. As sea levels rise, the low-lying islands of his home could vanish off the map. That's because the average height of islands in Tuvalu is less than 2 metres above sea level.
The Pacific Islands that are bearing the brunt of climate crisis must be compensated for the damage that they have already experienced and support to protect the people, the land and their culture from climate destruction.
Because, as Tangaloa Cooper Halo explains, the urgency is now.
In Australia, you can stop, pause, play on the conversations around climate change. Well, in the Pacific, we don't have that luxury. And I think the reason why other larger countries like Australia have that luxury is because it's not at the doorstep of every man, woman and child. The threatened livelihoods, the coastal erosion, coastal inundation, saltwater intrusion that affects the water lens, that affects the water supply and food security. Australians don't meet those challenges day to day. Pacific do.
In 2015, talks in Paris really kicked off the Green Climate Fund when developed nations promised to raise $100 billion a year from 2020 to 2025 to support climate change adaptation and mitigation in vulnerable countries. But it's not as straightforward as you would expect. Red tape is making it hard for countries to easily access funds. Maina Talia again.
It's pretty difficult for countries like Tuvalu to access this kind of funding. It should be accessible. Getting all this process must be put into very simple strategies.
Garth Henderson in Cook Islands agrees.
And in countries like ours where data is poor, research is hard, you know, the step from financing towards implementation, particularly adaptation, takes a long time.
Developed countries need to ensure that the money works for developing countries, not just provide it as their contribution and walk away from that. Countries need just to make sure that the developing countries are able to access and not wait for a long time for reviews. The amount of back and forth that we go through is unreal. That said, a couple of our countries have accessed the funding.
With the cyclone season looming, rising sea levels and increasing debt, Garth Henderson says bills are continuing to stack up.
We have to look after our coastlines. We've got to build our bridges. We've got to build our drains. We've got to relocate villages from coastal areas into the interior. We've got to do that.
Maina Talia says that money is needed now for adaptation measures.
Basically, the first one is to provide seawalls to protect the whole islands. And secondly, to raise the elevation of the island, to protect our shorelines, protect our islands. Because literally, if we continue to protect our islands, simply we are also protecting our people to sustain not just as human beings, but also the cultural identity that attached to us and to our land.
Which is why he wants developed countries to act.
Countries like Australia, China, the US and so forth, they really need to step up. We understand that this is very political in a sense because of their economic reliance on fossil fuel. But this is something that they really need to look seriously into it, their climate actions, their moral responsibilities.
Garth Henderson is tired of Pacific countries not being listened to.
Every year we go and make the same complaints.
This year at COP26, Tangaloa Cooper Halo says the money needs to be a priority.
You can't just adapt forever. This is a big COP. This is the deal breaker.
Tangaloa Cooper Halo, the Director of Climate Change Resilience at SPREP, the Secretariat of the Pacific Regional Environment Program, ending that report that was compiled with production support from Talia Olatia. And I'd love to know what you think about the COP26 talks that are coming up. Have you got your eye on it approaching in November? You heard there from people across the Pacific expressing their desire to have money and climate finance as a big discussion on the table for negotiations when when all the leaders actually meet. I'd love to hear what you think about that. Do you care about the fact that bigger economies at the moment are kind of just putting money on the table and not necessarily changing exactly their domestic policies? Get in touch. You can head over to the ABC Radio Australia, the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page to get in touch. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Now, it's sometimes referred to as the food of the gods. But taro plants are under increasing threat from climate change. The root vegetable is a staple food for many Pacific Islanders, but in some parts of the region, it's becoming harder to grow because of an increase in soil salinity caused by rising sea levels. So now, as Marion Farr reports, in an attempt to find new varieties of taro that can withstand salty conditions, researchers have been jumping into canoes and scouring rivers of southeast Queensland in Australia.
Now we are going to show you how to cook the taro.
If you do a quick search on YouTube, you'll come across hundreds of videos on how to prepare taro.
And that's how we're going to do it. So Grandpa's going to show me how to fishy the taro.
Fishy taro, this is
the large root vegetable is used in cooking around the world, but perhaps most prominently in the Pacific.
Taro is something that we eat every day.
Tusani Luasamotu Tusani Nuusa is a taro farmer in Samoa.
So even if we don't have fish or meat or anything, but as long as we have taro on the table with coconut cream, and we'll still survive with that.
Today, taro is one of Tusani's most valuable crops. But in the 1990s, when she was just starting out in agriculture, a destructive fungus known as leaf blight decimated Samoa's taro industry.
I was in the middle of kind of going on commercial with farming with taro when the flights came. It was so very hard at the time. And we were working together with the agriculturists over here in the research to look for a solution.
That solution involved finding new types of taro that were resistant to the disease. Now, the industry is back in full swing. As well as selling domestically, Tusani exports her taro to New Zealand and the US. But there's a new threat to the crop that's beginning to worry scientists and farmers in the Pacific.
I think we know that our nearest neighbours in the Pacific are very vulnerable to the effects of climate change, particularly in the coastal regions where rising sea levels and lowering water tables lead to saline soils.
Dr. Millicent Smith is a plant physiologist at the University of Queensland in Australia. She says domesticated taro crops, the types grown in farms around the Pacific, are sensitive to salty soil.
So salinity really reduces the growth of plants. It stops plants from being able to basically function in their normal way, and it limits growth and eventually kills a lot of plants.
To combat the problem, scientists are taking a similar approach to when they address taro leaf blight. They're trying to find different varieties of taro that might be more suited to growing in salty soil.
And we're trying to identify and exploit the mechanisms that might be there in some of the diverse or older taro varieties to make them better adapted to these future challenges.
To do that, they're working with the region's largest scientific organisation, the Pacific Community, to analyse a massive gene bank of taro crops from around the world. But they're also looking for new types of taro that may not have even been recorded yet, starting in their own backyard.
One of the coolest things about taro that I've found out through this project is that we actually have wild relatives of taro in Queensland.
So, as part of their research, Dr. Smith and her colleagues have been hunting for the taro plants around Brisbane and southeast Queensland.
We've been canoeing along the Brisbane River from the bay out to the west, trying to find and identify different taro, and we've found heaps so far, which has been really exciting.
What they've discovered holds some hope for the future of taro farming in the Pacific.
Particularly around Brisbane and Moreton Bay, you see taro wild relatives and also sort of a weedy taro growing in areas where there's a lot of salt. So around the bay, in close to waterways and wetlands. And so we think that these taro wild relatives that are found in Queensland might have characteristics that allow it to be much better adapted to salinity than the varieties that are found within the Pacific.
It's a big job for a small team. So Dr. Smith is also calling on people in the community to get involved.
We're using an app called iNaturalist, which is a publicly available app. It's really helpful, and it actually identifies everything for you. When you take a photo of it, it will suggest what the species might be. So if you're not sure if it could be taro, you could suggest that it might be. And then lots of people who are using the app for citizen science projects around Australia are able to tell you if it is or not. And then it will automatically be added to our project so we can see where you found it.
Molecular geneticist Dr. Bradley Campbell says the taro database is important not just for the Pacific, but the entire globe.
It's a good insurance policy. And from a food security perspective, whether it's caused by climate change or whether it's caused by just the normal vagaries of agriculture, it's good to have that diversity there.
And he thinks the collaborative partnership could become a model for future research.
I think this sort of science where the Pacific Islands takes the front stage and they do most of the DNA fingerprinting, for example, and Australia / University of Queensland is doing a lot more of the consulting, I think is a good arrangement for the future.
While Samoan farmer Tusani isn't feeling the impact of climate change on her crops at the moment, there's one thing she's sure of. Anything that will help protect the future of taro, anything that will help protect the future of taro is something she supports.
Planting taro, now we look at not only for our food on the table, but we plant taro to get money, to earn money and live.
Samoan farmer Tusani Lausamotu Tusani Nu'u'usa, ending that report from Marion Farm. That brings us to the end of Pacific Beat here on this Thursday morning. Thank you so much for your company today. I will be back, of course, tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but stay tuned here to ABC Radio Australia. You're headed right now for 5 minutes of the news.